Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
When it comes to hiring, don't search for a great talent. Match with them. Thanks to Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find qualified candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility. Go to Indeed.com/listen and tell them you heard about them from this podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
When I pull up to the parking lot, it's time to level up. Dial in, showing out for your team. Listen up, get you some. I stand the fan to give you what you need. Fan fuel, game time, turn up the intensity. Team colors bleeding now. 5 hour energy. For a limited time, get the fan fuel flavor at 5hourenergy.com.
Yeah, there should be some passion. This doesn't have to be boring.
Boring.
Okay, one thing the game needs is more people like you. You.
Still have grown men run around tight pants.
It's Mookie Betts.
This is Daniel Bard.
It's Steve Aoki.
Jared Saltalamacchia.
This is Brock Holt.
Hey, this is John Lester.
Baseball
isn't boring.
Welcome to Baseball Isn't Boring. Here's your host, Rob Radford.
There's no human being I'd rather be talking to right now than Brian Banister. And it's not just because he has the most elite podcast setup. I mean, is that set up for your general Zoom calls? Like when you get on with pitchers and executives and you just like, hey, I'm just going to dominate the background. What is happening?
You know me. I was an art major, photography guy. I wanted to be a Hollywood cinematographer. So I just hate bad setups. It does look more professional when you jump on with all these free agents and you're trying to convince them and recruit them to join you in the off season, but I think it just, it is a fun environment, and I do podcast stuff and jump on with other people. So it comes in handy. I'm just sitting in my garage right now.
Well, as you say that, we are doing a makeshift Baseballs and Boring studio. I am not in the Baseballs and Boring studio. I have a wrestling mat in back of me. But it doesn't matter because baseball conversation is baseball conversation. So let me start here, Brian. This is what we always talk about every year that you've come on, the sort of the evolution of baseball and pitching, right? What's next? And I think I've worn out your split finger take. I mean, not only on podcast, but just in general conversation with players to make it look like I'm really know what I'm talking about. So you were a big proponent of split finger fastball. Two things. Number one, have you seen a change or more of an acceptance in that in the last year since we talked last? And is there another thing coming down the road that you think, okay, people are going to be trying this out?
I think splitters have definitely gotten rid of their stigma a little bit. You see the Japanese pitchers coming over and they all have them and they're all nasty. You've seen more teams willing to experiment with it just because of all the analysts. It's the best performing pitch in baseball. Why not throw it? It's the least used pitch. Pitchers get hurt anyways. So, you know, what's really another potential small layer risk? When in fact the numbers don't back up that it's harder on the arm. The fastball, in fact, is the hardest pitch on the arm, without a doubt, the highest torque, the highest arm speeds. So I think the league has gone forward. The pitchers that have thrown it into their arsenals have benefited from it. I don't think it's a trend that's going away. And it's just such a great pitch and it's fun for everybody to watch, you know, with the knuckleballs kind of going away. It's the next best thing for me.
Okay. So along those lines, I sat down during the World Series and talked to Brett Honeywell. You know where I'm going to go with this, right? Which is the screwball. And he learned the screwball from his cousin, his great cousin, whatever, Mike Marshall, who way back when threw it. Not, to my knowledge and to his knowledge, nobody really else throws a screwball, and you can correct that. That's fine. That would have the same sort of stigma to it, you know, that you can't throw this because it's going to ruin your elbow. It's going to ruin your arm. What's your take on the screwball?
Pronation isn't bad for the arm, and you get into, you know, the Marshall way of pitching, and everything is heavy pronation. So it kind of fits in that style of thinking and mechanics and arm action. I think what we've been able to do, and you brought up, we were talking earlier, you know, somebody like a Devin Williams, what Luke Weaver did in the postseason, we've been able to design changeups, especially using the seam effects and different qualities, the more pronation qualities of different pitchers. We've been able to recreate a lot of the characteristics of a screwball without really trying to get into the heavy arm action that it requires, which is essentially a backwards curveball. We've been able to recreate most of the movement just through a change of grip with added seam movement. And I think that's where most of the industry has gone, which is why it's still an outlier pitch.
So you had mentioned Devin Williams. As we're taping this right now, this news just came down that he was traded to the Yankees. I always love talking to you. I remember we did sort of, okay, give me your top five most unique pitches. And, you know, this is going back, you know, Craig Kimbrell's curveball and Devin Williams has to be up there in terms of what he delivers with that changeup. I'm really fascinated to get your sort of take on him. And if you want, you integrate Luke Weaver too, because I think that these are two guys who, if you look at the Yankees bullpen now, it's, man, that's tough, but it's because of unique pitches, isn't it?
Yeah. With all the velo in the game, the outlier pitches are able to stand out from the crowd. And, you know, with these hit batting machines that can recreate any pitch, hitters are getting better at the sweepers and the typical offerings from a pitcher. So when somebody can throw something totally unique from everybody else, and I've only had in all my coaching years one other pitcher capable of spinning a changeup the way that Devin Williams does, kind of 3,000 RPMs in the wrong direction. Because most of the time in the draft or in trade scenarios, you get a pitcher that can really spin the ball, curveball. It's pretty unique and you're highly valued. But almost always the case is when you throw a changeup, spin rate goes down. So if your fastball is at 2,400, your changeup's going to be at 2,000. So you almost see a drop off in changeups typically. So when somebody has a big jump in changeup spin, it really shows a unique talent with their ability to pronate through their wrists and fingers. And you just can't teach it as a coach. So the player either has that inherent capability, which makes him a unicorn, or he doesn't.
How's he do it? I mean, I know that's a simple question, but when you break down a Devin Williams, is this an arm flexibility? Is the way that his body's built? I don't know. Like, we all have the slow motion cameras now, and we can break this down to like we never have before. So for your perspective, how's he do it?
It's really range of motion at the wrist and just inherent spin talent. Some guys can just spin the ball. It's their elastic tissue. It's just springy and they spin it. And so the ability to do it inversely in the opposite direction is just insanely wild. I've literally seen two pitchers in all my years that could do it. And, it's really a fascinating pitch. And to me, it's the modern day screwball.
Who's the other one?
He's actually a high school pitcher down at IMG Academy. I've done lessons with him and, it's fascinating to watch.
Really?
He's going to be a name. Yeah. It's fun to watch him throw it. And, it's the closest to Devin Williams I've ever seen.
We can't give, is his name secret? I mean, or do we want
to keep it a secret for now? But
oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Keep an eye out for righties down at IMG Academy.
All right. Listen, is Cason Gabbard still the coach down there?
I actually don't know, but, okay. Gabby goes back to the fall league days for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm just pretending like I know stuff about high school baseball. So, you know, so far we're geeking out on a lot of pitch stuff, which is great. But you, and things are coming up in my head as you're talking. One of them, you mentioned traject machine. We've had a lot of conversations about this going back to, when Matt Strom informed us in February that there was going to be allowed for hitters to look at the traject machine during the games. Which, you know, and he was upset about that because once again, it made sense to me what he was saying. This is tilting it more once again to the hitters because in bullpens, you aren't able to use TrackMan and it's not the same comparisons. Now that we're a year into that, what's your thoughts on that? Was it a difference maker? Was it something that we should get riled up over? Is it something that we should adjust and we should defer to the pitchers and give them something? Well, what's your take on that?
The pitchers have had all the advantages over the years. We're kind of the first mover advantage. We set the table. The hitters eat off the table. hitters have to swing at what we give them. So I've been in favor of a long time of kind of rebalancing a little bit in the hitter's favor. Pitching trends lately have been just about pounding the strike zone, and you've seen strikeout rates come down a little bit and strike rates go up. So I love the concept of the traject machines. Initially, the teams that bought it, the hitters didn't like it because the machines were so nasty because it's recreating exactly what the pitchers throw. So you're getting your bats broken, you're hitting off the end, you're swinging missing, you're fouling off your foot, all of the above. But what teams quickly flipped to were balls that were the same weight, but softer in nature and still have the same flight characteristics. So you get all the benefit of hitting off the pitcher you're about to face, without the penalty of if you foul it off your shin, you're going to be limping up to your next at bat. So most teams have gone to those types of balls, and that's really unlocked the capabilities of the traject machine. And now you can write scripts and custom program it. So that not only does it throw all the pitches of the pitcher you're about to face, but it'll actually recreate his pitch usage, the areas he likes to throw it to, you know, kind of evaluating your own hitter heat maps, your own scouting reports, and also building in the random misses that all pitchers inevitably have. So you get the full experience and you can go through 5, 6, 7 at bats before you actually get in the game. Really hitting off the exact pitcher with the exact characteristics you're about to face.
I've talked about the traject machine way too much on this podcast because you just took it to another level. I appreciate that. But it was because as the year went on and we were talking about this, number one, it was amazing how many teams didn't even have it. Like, I know that the Red Sox had 3 of them. They had 1 in Fort Myers, 1 in Worcester, and they may have been the only one with the minor leagues. And it was certainly one in Boston. And Derek Falvey was talking about how at first the supply couldn't keep up with the demand. They didn't have enough of them. They were like $800,000. Like, so, I mean, they're expensive, but they initially couldn't make them fast enough. But it seems like I got to imagine, like, do you guys have them with the White Sox or?
We will this year for the first time.
Yeah. So a perfect example, right? I mean, it's like, I think more teams will have them. So anyway, I've talked way too much about the Traject machine. So you're welcome, Traject company. I mean, your stock has never been higher. But I want to come back to what I said. You know, we talk about the evolution of pitching over the last year and so much of it, like you said, is sort of the raise. Let's throw strike one, throw your best pitch for strike one. And now you're hearing more and more and more of that. With, you know, we see certain teams like the Red Sox, like holy mackerel, never throwing a 4-seam fastball almost ever, you know, but these are just a couple examples from your perspective over the last year. What has changed about pitching the most?
I think it's the off season, honestly, with all the tech getting into all the facilities and the level of, training that these pitchers can get in the offseason. There was once, you know, back in Fort Myers back in the day, we were talking about building a hotel on the JetBlue campus and keeping the pitchers there all offseason and we get to train. Really, that has materialized, but it's happened at these facilities, whether you're at Tread in Charlotte or Push in Tempe or Driveline in Seattle. These guys go and they get elite training year round now. It's not like there's a massive drop off. And in some cases, depending on the organization, you're actually getting improved facilities, improved tech, and access to anything you want access to. So I think that has drastically improved both the quality control, raised the floor of the average pitcher, and given opportunities for independent league pitchers or pitchers that were hurt to really reinvent themselves or resuscitate their careers and come back to spring training, completely new people. And so pitching is so malleable nowadays in that you can change pitchers, you can use their usage, give them a new grip, give them a new shape, train and get their, you know, we call it their engine higher, where they come back drastically stronger than the year before. And these facilities are a big part of it. And I think that's probably the biggest change over the last calendar year.
So the flip side of that is you're throwing more, right?
Like, yeah.
And so, and this is, you know, this is sort of going to lead into the another thing that's dominated us throughout the year, the question about pitching injuries. And we've had about 10 different reasons for it, all good. But one of them was pitchers are trying to maximize everything. They're throwing more. And not only are they throwing more, but they're throwing more with say, hey, listen, you know, let's learn a sweeper up at driveline and let's break it off, you know, really, really as good as you can. And maybe it's not the best time to do that. And you're doing it, and you're doing it, and you're doing it. Again, I'm no disrespect to driveline. They do great work, but this is a thing. This is a very real thing. And I don't know what your take on it is. I guess while I ask you this, so we can sort of centralize it, is I ask you that question. They've had meetings. I know they had meetings. MLB had meetings at the GM meetings. Certainly probably had at the winter meetings about let's find a solution to these arm injuries. What's your take on it?
I think we're at roughly plus or minus 40% Tommy Johns across Major League Baseball. Ooh. As far as all pitchers in the major leagues, 2 out of 5 have had that surgery, which is massive. And I think the tough thing is, no matter how much we get into the mechanics, we get into the prehab, you know, getting out in front of arm injuries, rehab. I think the simple fact is it's just like if you redline your car engine or you drive 90 miles an hour on the freeway, no matter how good your brakes are or how good your airbags are, driving faster and accelerating faster is either going to, you know, lead to an engine that fails faster, or in the case of an accident or something, it's going to be more dangerous than if you were driving at slower speeds. So I think that's the problem is in baseball, performance pays and velo plays. You know, there are guys with outlier characteristics, the Joe Ryans of the world, and guys that throw slower with late movement that are great pitchers. But for the majority of pitchers out there, velo is what makes you productive. It pays. And then if you complement that with a nasty secondary pitch, like a Devin Williams changeup, you're at the top of your sport. And so the chase for velo is never going to go away. And you can do everything you can on the medical side to reduce injuries or to mitigate them. But the fact is we're pushing performance and the ability to throw harder every single year. And as long as we keep doing that, the injuries will kind of track that trend. And so, I spoke about this at Saber Seminar in Chicago this past year. You know, that was typically held in Boston in the past. But what I talked about is, you know, it's the team's job and it's the athlete's job to push and maximize and optimize performance. That's our job. I believe it's honestly the job of the league or the sport to create barriers. So my analogy is usually in golf, in that for the major tournaments, they make the fairways narrower, they raise the rough, they give you restrictions on the size of your driver club head. Golf has a major golf ball restriction coming into play in the next couple of years where the average exit velo ball speed, coming off the driver is going to be mitigated. They're going to reduce it significantly just to keep the integrity of the courses. And I think baseball is ultimately heading to something like that. You know, we're not going to change the distance of the mound. We can change the composition of the baseball. We can make the strike zone a little tighter. We can force starting pitchers to go deeper into games via penalties, you know, kind of get rid of the opener concept, get rid of the bullpenning concept, and force the starter to go a certain number of innings or pitches, or you lose your DH. We can do things like that that start to force pitchers to throw more pitches, you know, relievers 5 outs instead of 3. And people will, you know, get very disgruntled about a lot of these concepts. But I think it's the job of the sport to balance the ever increasing performance of the teams and the athletes and their ability to push that with technology and analytics. And it just keeps the integrity of the game. It keeps it true to its original design. And I think it's honestly healthier because if pitchers have to throw more pitches, they're not going to throw as hard. If the zone's a little smaller, they have to prioritize a little more command over just pure stuff. And there's little things like that that start to move the needle in the opposite direction. They're not fun to talk about, but I think that is the only thing that will truly kind of change the ever increasing trend in velocity and injuries and start to swing it back in the other direction.
Well, see how you just explained it. I could get my head around, like, so when it was leaked out about that, we have to make starting pitchers throw six innings, right? Everyone was like, no, but it makes more sense if you talk about, well, there's a penalty. Okay. It's not like you have to, but there's a penalty if you do it, or going from the three outs to the five outs. Like, it's still, like you said, people are still going to be up in arms and how you do this, but there has to be, you mentioned it, is much like golf, it's Major League Baseball. They can't say to a guy, you cannot throw 100 miles an hour. You cannot do that. So don't try. That's not happening. But right, those things are, I don't want to say feasible or reasonable, but it's just maybe just like the most realistic, right? I mean, and I have this, do you get the sense that, again, am I wrong in saying that when that was let out, it wasn't what like you described, you know what I'm saying? And that was unfortunate, I guess.
Yeah, it can be framed, you know, in the right light, as far as being good at the game. If you look at any double A pitching prospect that goes up to triple A for the first time with the automatic zone, that's not in the big leagues yet, but probably the challenge zone is coming at some point where it's automatic, but the umpire still makes the call and then the catcher, the hitter can challenge it. I actually like that version because it rewards a hitter with a good eye, or it rewards a catcher that knows the zone really well. But you start seeing these pitchers go from double A to triple A. And the number one thing you see in all their stat lines is their walk rate goes up, because all of a sudden the zone becomes the rulebook zone, as opposed to catchers are really good at what they do. They frame the ball effectively and fool the umpire. And especially these mid to high 90s speeds, it's almost impossible to judge a quarter of an inch with the human eye at how fast that ball is moving. And so the catchers are magicians at what they do. And you get to this rulebook zone where Tuesday through Thursday, the machine calls it, all of a sudden the walk rate skyrocket, hitters get a little more patient, there's more base runners, ERAs go up, all of the above. It starts to swing it back in favor of the hitters. Mm-hmm. And I think we will see some variation of that. I don't like purely automatic, but I do like the challenge zone. It's really fun when a pitch is thrown, the catcher knows it's a strike, or the hitter knows it's a strike, the umpire calls it a ball, they show it on the scoreboard, and all of a sudden everybody sees this 3D animation and everybody's cheering, holding their beer, you know, and all of a sudden the umpire is proven wrong. Because I think everybody that's ever been to a baseball game wants the umpire to be wrong, and nobody's ever there to change his call. So I love umpires, but they are wrong at a certain rate. And so it's fun when the fans and the hitter or the catcher have a chance to actually be good at their craft, at their zone judgment, and really kind of get one back.
It's basically just like the instant replay, but with balls and strike, which is, I think that if we go back, like, oh, we can't have instant replay. And then everyone's like, how did we live without instant replay? A lot of these rules, like we say, how is this going to happen? Then we say, of course we're going to do that. I mean, pitch clock is probably another one. So it sounds like for you, you know, like, and doesn't surprise me, because I think we had a conversation even a few years ago where you eloquently said everything is predicated on power, 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 hitting power, pitching power. You're not walking in the door without power. Is there anything else that, like, cause some of the things that were brought up, pitch clock, you know, the speed of it, right? Not being able to recover. That's another thing that people sort of pointed to. I'm kind of erring on the side of what you're saying. I just think everything is, you know, this max effort and really 40%, holy mackerel. I mean, really. So I don't know if there's anything else at all.
I think the game is actually starting to do a good job of regulating itself. It's tricky. It's a traditional game. It's been around for 100 plus years. and we've never messed with it. And so a lot of these rules start to mess with the game. But I think restoring it to its original balance, now that we have analytics, that we have pitch data, which all started in 2007, it's really just regulating this latest, you know, 15 to 18 year phase of the game, and making sure that it doesn't distort the original designs, the original dimensions of the ballparks, et cetera. And it kind of keeps it true and gives you that fan experience and kind of, not just three true outcomes all the time, but actually kind of this narrative, this storyline, this, David versus Goliath battle that you're looking for when you go to a game. And it's the type of game that you remember as a kid, and it keeps you a fan through your adulthood.
All right. So everyone's saying, why haven't you asked about the Garrett Crochet trade? We're, you know, 25 minutes in. But you know, this is all lead in. You don't spoil the meat and potatoes right out of the gate. Right. There's obviously two elements to this. There's two guys that I want to ask about. There's Crochet, but there's also Gonzalez, the guy that you got back. Weichelman Gonzalez. I'll start with Crochet. I had the opportunity to sit down with Garrett. He talked about sort of his evolution, about how Chris Getz had the meeting that they had about making him a starter. And then he excels as a starter. He trains as a starter. And I don't think he pitched beyond four innings after July 8th. You probably were in the belly of the beast when it came to all those conversations. Talk to me about the evolution, I guess, over the last year of Garrett Crochet.
Garrett is tremendous. And the first thing that stands out is his physicality. You know, I've been around Paul Skeens, Mark Pryor, a lot of these bigger bodies, and he's in that category. He's the type of guy, I describe it because he's great and he's friendly, but you wouldn't want to run into him in a dark alley because he's so much more physically massive than me. And I'm not small, I'm 6'1", 225, but he just towers over me. So one, the physicality's there. Two, he throws 100 miles an hour from the left side, which is kind of an outlier on its own. There's only a few guys, you know, the Chapman signing. There's only a few guys out there from the left side that can hit those kind of numbers. And so he's got a special physical talent. And the White Sox in the past with certain pitchers have really pushed them up to the big leagues fast. You know, Chris Sale was one. There's many notable lefties in their organization over the years that really raced through the minor leagues. And so him having started in college and having proven he can do that, being shot straight up to the big leagues, pitching dominantly in his first year, you know, hitting well above 100 miles an hour and being very productive out of the bullpen, going through the arm injury, which, as we've been talking about, 2 out of 5 pitchers go through. Not a big deal anymore. We have the surgery and the technology to deal with it. Coming back, and I got hired in September of 23. And so I went out there. I remember we went through a bullpen. He was dealing with walks a little bit, but he was really just like most pitchers coming back from Tommy John and trying to find his way again. Sometimes the surgery, you're trying to get your proprioception, your feel back. And I mean, he was dominant, but he hadn't really found it yet. And when we went into that last offseason, he just completely 100% committed to being a starter again. And we were all unsure just because he hadn't really done it in pro ball, even though he had done it in college. And to his credit, as he was sending videos in from the offseason at his facility, it was really looking good. And we were still unsure. He was going to be a dominant closer for me. And he came out and he just continued to shove in spring training. And then Chris Getz, I give him all the credit on the call. He made the call, your starter, your opening day, let's go. And, he put it in Garrett's court, and Garrett came out and was absolutely dominant. And, I said this throughout the year. I think Garrett would have won the Cy Young last year if he had just been allowed to be himself. I don't think it was in his best interest long term. But if you look at his rate stats, his ability to strike people out, his ability to get swing and miss in the zone, his ability to limit his walks, he will give up a homer now and then. But I think he's in the inner circle of the five best pitchers in baseball next year. So the Red Sox really got a special arm. And he put the work in. He has this kind of Vulcan split change thing now. We had messed at the end of 23 with seam effects on his two seamer to get some late movement. He added that in towards the end of the year and it was all over. Pitching Ninja, I mean, he's throwing 97 to 100 mile an hour late sinking two seamers, which no other lefty on earth can throw. And the big change, I give this credit to Ethan Katz. He was getting clipped on a sweeper a little bit by righties down and in, and they flipped to the cutter. We had messed around with the cutter in spring training on the pitch design side, and he flipped to a cutter, and it was just devastating. So when you pair 100 miles an hour with his riding cut fastball with that down and in cutter to righties, he just took off. So you're basically getting an elite closer, almost like an Aroldis Chapman type, but a guy that's capable of going six innings and maintaining that level of performance. And I really think the Red Sox got somebody special.
So when the decision is made to draw him back, you know, and to, he's still like, I remember Grady Sizemore sitting there in September and saying, hey, listen, no, he's making starts. Like, we want to start, but he's just only going to go four innings. So when that decision's made, what was the thought process? Was it just simply, listen, the guy's thrown as I think he, Crochet told me, he's like, I've thrown 200 innings total, you know, in my existence. So what was that, just the thought of, because it was, or was there anything, we're seeing this, we need to draw back on it?
You know, coming off a major surgery, we had multiple plans designed, and honestly, the original iteration of his workload was throwing even less innings, just because, you know, every team has their own metric. You've thrown this many innings in the past, you know, getting to 60, 80% of that would be appropriate. And he was the one that insisted that he continue to go out and make those starts every fifth day. So there were scenarios where he was going to go more to like a bullpen role or start the game and only pitch one or two innings, just to make sure his total workload for the year was responsible relative to the recency of his surgery. And he insisted on it, his agent insisted on it, and we were fine with it. I mean, having a dominant pitcher like him out there every fifth day is great, especially because we lacked offense. And he just went out there, took the ball, and he's a workhorse. And I think that's what's undervalued currently, is how good he's going to be in a full season once he can throw six, seven innings for an entire year. I think it wouldn't surprise me if he's a 6-8 WAR pitcher next year. And, you know, you look at like the Yankees signing with Max Fried. Max Fried's best season, was 4.9 WAR. Garrett Crochet was 4.7, and we had to throttle him. He didn't pitch a full season. So in a full season of pitching, I think he's going to get to levels that very few pitchers in the game right now are capable of achieving, because he has so much ability to miss bats in the zone.
So in the package that you guys got coming back from, three position players and one pitcher, the one pitcher, Wykelmyn Gonzalez, who is an interesting guy, because if you look at a year ago, I think he was perceived as, if not the top pitching prospect for the Red Sox, one of the top two, along with, I think, Luis Perales. But so when, I don't know, when they're talking about this, how much you look at him, what you know about him, because this is what White Sox fans want to know, right? I mean, you give up a Crochet, you want all four guys, you want to know everything about them. So what's your take on him?
Yeah, you get into these types of deals, and whether it was the Gerrit Cole deal with the Pirates, or, you know, the typical format is four players. It's generally one to two headliners. It's a third very good player, and then it's a fourth that you're betting on the upside. And, you know, Wykelmyn, like, he got there, I think we signed him in 2019. So I was still with the Red Sox at the time, and he was a special arm. You look back to his 2023 numbers, he had one of the highest K percentages in minor league baseball. So there's no doubting the stuff. The thing that I'm excited about with him, and when you're in these trade deals, you can only ask for so much. I think from the fan side, you have these like dream trades that you make with like baseball cards. And the reality is there's a lot riding on this. You know, people's jobs are at stake. There's a lot of money involved. So you can only ask for so much. And from our end, we were looking, for some premium bats, and, the Red Sox were one of the only teams that had that, because we're trying to rebuild a position player core that gives us a chance to win in a few years, at a very high level. And you see the Astros, the Red Sox, all these teams that have won sustainably over the years. They started with a position player core. So those names were important to us. We never were able to access names like that in the Dylan Cease trade. Really teams were just offering us arms only. And so, to get some bats made us a good match for the Red Sox. And, then with Gonzalez, there's velo there. There's athleticism. There's the heavy ability to spin the ball. The thing I'm excited about adding and experimenting with him on is adding a little bit of a two seamer in, not exclusively, but, just to add to his kind of fastball diversity, I call it. Sometimes if you're either walking people or your fastball is getting hit despite its velo, a lot of times the solution is just to show a different version of a fastball to some extent. Even if it's 10-20%, it can really help. And there's been a lot of studies done on that lately for pitchers whose four seamer gets hit or who walk too many people with just one fastball. It can really be helpful to add a second one in. And so his ability to shape and spin that breaking ball at 3000 RPMs, you combine that with kind of a two seamer that's moving in the opposite direction and contrasting that pitch very well, I think gives him the chance to kind of be that arm and that prospect that people were talking about last year. So in any of these trades, you know, you're trying to find value add after the fact. That's kind of what I've been a part of for the last decade. And that's the fun part for me on the player development side. But for us, it checked a lot of boxes on what we need as an organization. And I think it gives the Red Sox literally a Cy Young candidate, ready to go. I'm close with Bailey. I'm close with Holt out in the bullpen. I've gotten to know Willard this offseason. It's a great pitching group. And I think they're going to really be able to take Garrett to the next level. And it's going to be the type of arm that handles that Baltimore offense that goes blow to blow with the Yankees, that they need to win the AL East.
Well, so you just jacked everyone up. All right. There you go. All right. Well,
fan at heart. I still got the ring.
He still got the ring. Well, I hope there's many more rings in your future. And I always love talking with you, Brian. Thank you so much, man. Appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it. Always good to be here.